You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. As promised, a Roland Garros check-in. It is Friday. We always need to time these things. Rafa Nadal is on his way to another straight set win. As we speak, Stan Wawrinka has just been eliminated by Gaston, the French wild card who is ranked outside the top 200. It's been a crazy day. It's been a crazy tournament. It's cold. It's wet. It's rainy. COVID, alas, is spiking, and yet we have major tennis. So I figured we would just sort of catch up and talk some themes from halfway through the 2020 French Open. Jamie Lasanti back in what is surely a more climatic and I hope a little healthier COVID-wise United States. How are you, Jamie?
Doing all right. How are you? More importantly, as you said, cold, rainy, gloomy. Give us beyond the weather report, how's it faring over there in Paris?
Exactly. You kind of nailed it, which is in some ways it's a little grim, and in other ways, I don't know, it's a major tennis tournament, and right now I'm watching Rafa Nadal and Novak Djokovic and Dominic Thiem and Simona Halep play brilliantly today, and it's really this dissonance where people are wearing masks, there are not a lot of fans, there are fears that the trends in Paris are not going in the right direction. By Monday there might be some sort of a restaurant ban, and yet against that backdrop we still have glorious major tennis. It's not been a great tournament in terms of weather. Right now it's very cold. I'm pacing to keep warm. I think people forget too, Paris is the same longitude as Newfoundland, so it's been getting dark quite early here, much different than what we're accustomed to in June, when oftentimes the sessions can go till 9 o'clock. One of the godsends here is that this is the first year of the roof, so because of the darkness and the rain, we're still able to, despite that, we're still able to get in four or five matches on the main court every day. But it's it's been weird. I mean, it's sort of been this mix of apocalypse and then glorious major tennis with the best players in the world playing at a high level. We've had some five setters. We've had great matches. We've had upsets. We've had a lot of upsets, in fact. 19 seeded players on the women's side out by the third round. And at the same time, there haven't really been titanic upsets. Simona Halep has looked great. Nadal, Djokovic, Dominic Thiem, they've been COVID tested, but not particularly tested on the court. So, it's been a major like no other. And at the halfway point, I would say, you know, it's the COVID test. Most importantly, we have not had players testing positive, which I think was sort of the ultimate barometer. You have some complaints about the schedule, but you have those during the best of times. We haven't had great weather, but certainly not the first major where that's occurred. And I suspect a week from now we will crown a men's and women's champion, and people will decide, much like with the U.S. Open, that on balance, it was good that this persisted in spite of these adverse conditions. How's that for a mushy answer on both sides, isn't it, Jamie?
No, it's a good scene setter, and you mentioned the U.S. Open, and that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you about, because I have been comparing and contrasting the two tournaments. Of course, obviously it happened so quickly, one after the other, but for me, I feel like the U.S. Open had a different feel, and I think as you talk about the weather and the difference in the sun's going down and the darkness and how it's sort of gloomy and cold and very different conditions than we're used to at the French Open. I'm curious how you compare the overall just feeling and environment from one major to the other. Obviously, you weren't at the U.S. Open, so it's a little more difficult. But do you think that the fact that the U.S. Open was sort of on schedule with when we're used to it has, in comparison to now, the French Open being at this weird time in September, do you feel like it has taken a little bit of the air out of the major? Because I think on my side, from my perspective, I do feel like there's a little bit of a strange, I keep saying the word gloomy, but just lackluster a little bit in some ways in this tournament compared to the U.S. Open. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think that's a really good point, that the U.S. Open had no fans and we had this bubble protocol and it was strange, but it was still held at the appointed dates. This is a strange tournament because, you know, it's October. We've never had major tennis in October before. We're talking about clay. So the clay of October is much different from the clay of late May and early June. Again, we have this darkness factor. We have this great roof, but it's the first year of the roof. And I think the other thing that people forget is that Roland Garros is really in Paris. It's right in the Bois de Boulogne. It is, you know, it's 2 miles from my hotel. It's about, you know, maybe took me 11 minutes to get here, and I'm staying in the Trocadero neighborhood right in the middle of everything. That's a lot different from being out in Queens, out of Manhattan. A lot different for the players going to a Marriott in the suburbs versus going to their hotels, which are kind of sort of locked down, but this is clearly a bubble that's been permeated. It's just a much different context than the U.S. Open. And I think the other thing is that there was no way to know this in advance when people were, you know, deciding to go forward with these events, and in the case of the French Open, seizing other dates on the calendar. But when the U.S. Open occurred, the COVID rates in New York City were trending in the right direction. They were going down. New York City was quite safe. And it's the opposite here. I mean, apart from everything else and all the other challenges and the weather and the darkness, it's getting a little scary in terms of the second wave. And we're supposed to have an announcement by government ministers and maybe even Prime Minister Macron essentially saying that we're going to have to ramp up some of these protocols, that bars and restaurants may be closing. There were 14,000 cases in France. So apart from everything else and the strange time of year and the strange surface, I think there's an element of concern here. And one of the sort of behind the scenes stories is what's going to happen to the rest of the year. Is this it for tennis in 2020, in the year 2020? And there are other events on the calendar, but they're indoor events. You can hear the applause for Nadal behind me. They're indoor events. And if you can't have people going into restaurants, I'm not sure you can have indoor tennis events.
Right.
So there's a lot of uncertainty here. And at the same time, you know, it's funny because you see Nadal on the court and, you know, Taylor Fritz just played a tiebreaker that was more than half an hour. And you sort of have these very normal and conventional conversations about tennis and who can string together back-to-back wins and what you need to do to beat Simona Halep, who moves so well. And then the next conversation you have 90 seconds later is sort of apocalyptic conversations about COVID and shutting down businesses. So it's, dissonant is the word I keep coming back to, because in some ways it seems very much like a major tournament with drama and upsets and ascending players and what's going on with so-and-so. And then in other ways, it's sort of playing as this backdrop of gloom. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so do you think that with those potential new protocols outside of tennis in Paris generally, you know, looming, do you think that that's going to affect the protocols within Roland Garros? Are they going to mid-tournament decide that fans are no longer allowed, or are you expecting any changes to the tennis itself, or do you think it will just be for restaurants and other things for the public?
It's a great question. I will let you keep it between us, but I'll let you in on a deep, dark secret, which is, you know, the U.S. Open, most of the revenue is generated by this ESPN contract, which, you know, is in all in probably approaching $100 million. And it's all about TV. The French Open doesn't have that kind of a huge revenue stream from a single TV contract. They make a lot of their revenues by selling tickets and by hospitality. And sort of there are always these jokes about the fans aren't in the seats because the lunch and the catering is so good. And the French Open went on in part because initially they were expected to get, again, this was coming right from their interactions with government. They were told they could get 11,500 fans a day, which is, you know, almost a 20, you know, it's almost a 75% drop from what it typically is. But, you know, 11,500 fans, and there's catering and there's suites and there's hospitality. That's a lot of revenue. That number then dropped to 5,000 on the eve of the tournament, literally days before the tournament, it dropped to 1,000. And I cannot imagine that, again, if bars and restaurants get shut down, they will be allowing 1,000 fans into a venue. And strangely enough, they seem to pack these fans together. I posted a picture on Twitter of a match that Caroline Garcia just played with Elisa Mertens. And they're easily 1,000 fans, and they're not spaced out evenly. And I think that's going to change in week two, especially if we have this restaurant ban. Right. There will be fewer players on the grounds. Again, knock wood. For all intents, there was sort of the Fernando Verdasco controversy. But for all intents, there has not been a positive test among a player, which is great. Again, we have, you know, at some level, you cover this as a conventional tennis tournament, and they're great storylines, and they're stories that haven't really taken shape, and Serena pulled out. But I think for the players that remain, yeah, it's got to be a bit of a concern. I've talked to other players who are worried even about sort of, what do I do about changing my flights? Am I going to be able to get out of here if I come from France, which is suddenly a red country that they call it in the EU? Am I going to be able to get back into my country? Is this going to affect quarantine? So I feel like the French Open has done an admirable job. I feel like there's some bad luck. I feel like coming out of the U.S. Open, where these bubbles were so secure, it's probably an unfortunate look that there really isn't a bubble situation here. But again, it's a moving target. And if we'd had the same conversation, you know, today's October 2nd. If we'd had this August 2nd, we'd say, oh man, the U.S. Open really needs to reconsider it. And now, sort of circumstances have shifted.
Yeah, definitely. And so a little transition for you, but let's talk a little tennis. I know there's a lot of things in my mind that have stuck out. Of course, as you mentioned, Serena Williams pulling out with the Achilles injury. You've got Nadal rolling, Djokovic rolling, team is still rolling, you know, despite coming off that major high, you know, at the US Open. You've got Ostapenko kind of cementing herself here, you know, in a place where she has succeeded before. Simona Halep gets a bit of revenge, you know, today. So there's a lot going on. What's sort of stuck out to you? Who should we be watching that maybe we're missing beyond the big storylines?
I think you nailed it in the sense that there's been a lot of upsets and a lot of sort of quirky results, and yet all three favorites on both sides. So obviously Nadal, Djokovic, and team have looked great. Simona Halep looked great. Rusa had a tough first, but she's looked strong. Svitolina, I can't name one titanic seismic upset. I think there've been a number of storylines that haven't really materialized. So, you know, Coco Gauff played, I thought, just a terrific first match in horrible conditions. And she beats Joe Conta, you know, semifinalist last year, top 10 seed, and Coco Gauff in this sort of awful cold rain played the more composed match. And you say, wow, this is real. She showed me something. And then 2 days later, she comes back and loses to an Italian qualifier, and her serves deserts her. And Victoria Azarenka terrific U.S. Open. She looked good on the clay. She came here as, she spoke about her confidence level. And you said, this is a real contender. And then she went out, 6-2, 6-2, very, very meekly to Shmilova. Serena Williams looked pretty good. She played Christy on in the first round. The second set was 6-love. And then 2 days later, she pulls out with the Achilles injury. So I feel like there have been a number of storylines that sort of got a nice start. There's a Danish teenager who looked terrific beating Jen Brady, Clara Tauson. And she, body and mind couldn't quite keep pace. She had to qualify too, and she went out. So I feel like there have been some sort of false starts in terms of storylines. I think the big ones now are just for all the upsets and all the soft spots in the draw, and there are going to be some matches in the second week played between two players that conventional fans have not heard about. But I think in the end, the cream tends to rise, and when Nadal beats Djokovic or Djokovic beats Nadal or team wins a second major, and when Simona Halep backs us up, people are going to remember that and not sort of some of the soft rounds and the quarterfinalists that no one's heard of. So I think I think that's the way these tournaments always go to some extent, but here more than ever, we will remember the winners and not some of the sort of strange detours along the way.
Right.
Jamie, let's take a break from tennis chatter. How about a shout out to our sponsor, the good folks at Wilson. Great to have a tennis-themed sponsor, and we have exciting news for fans of Beyond the Baseline and Pro Staff Rackets. Wilson has just released the latest, greatest Pro Staff. It's the V13, and here is an offer exclusively for our listeners. If you order this awesome new racket from Wilson.com, Beyond the Baseline listeners should use the code BAGTHEBAG, B-A-G-T-H-E-B-A-G, BAG THE BAG. That's the code, and you get an exclusive gift with purchase. What is that gift with purchase? It is a red, white, and blue Wilson duffel. So visit Wilson.com/ProStaff, use the code BAGTHEBAG, and get a bag with your racket purchase. Hurry up. Do this while supplies last. This is a $50 value gift with purchase. Bag the bag at Wilson.com. And we thank Wilson for their tennis podcast sponsorship. Okay, back to tennis chatter. Chatter about many players who use Wilson rackets, we should add.
What can you tell us about Serena's withdrawal? So obviously, this is it for her after pulling out of French Open. She's basically done for the year. And, it's weird for her to hear her say, or to hear people say, I'm looking ahead to the Australian Open. It's weird given the, as you say, October and Roland Garros. But for her, obviously she's still chasing that number 24, and this injury apparently never fully healed. And so when I heard that she pulled out, and she wasn't hobbling anywhere, I thought it was actually a good sign that she's really taking into consideration a full 2021, or at least, trying to give it her all next year. But what did you hear about her injury? I mean, how bad is it? Do you think that it's something that she and her fans should be concerned about here? Or is she just playing it really, really safe during this time?
To me, the great mystery with Serena was, why was she playing here?
In the first
she wasn't place. Able to stay in her home. You know, why was she here in the first place? Exactly. She was coming off this U.S. Open. She had this Achilles injury. This is always going to be the surface that was going to give her the most trouble. It certainly wasn't going to help that it was the kind of clay that you can't really hit through. It's October. It's rainy. She's got to stay in a hotel. I mean, sort of every factor militated against her playing this event. I thought it was a good sign and impressive and admirable that she basically said, I want to win majors and I'm willing to endure some less than ideal circumstances. She has a place here and she has to stay in a hotel. I mean, just everything was sort of like, I never would have predicted she would have played.
Right.
I thought it was admirable that she did. I thought she looked pretty good. I mean, I didn't see a limp. I talked to her on the court right after the match, and it's not as though she grimaced or limped or even looked down. I was looking, watching the tape. It wasn't even as though she sort of, looked down at her leg.
Right.
She won the set 6-love. Yeah, exactly. I think the injury probably, I don't know how much of it is this hurts me today versus there's no way in hell I'm winning 6 more matches and I'm here to win titles and not just give these things shots. And when she sort of realized she wasn't going to be able to win 6 matches, it was, what am I doing here? And I think also she didn't want to make this worse for Australia, which, yes, as you say, and I think, you know, you're right, it's more than 90 days away, but it's definitely going to happen. Serena definitely has a better chance of winning Australia than she does on clay. But, you know, I mean, I just, you know, it's one of these things where you watch Serena for all these years, clear every bar and relentless success, and people write her off and she comes back, and people have been burned so many times shortchanging her, but it will now be 4 years since she last won a major. And you just sort of think if this doesn't happen soon here, it ain't going to happen. And if it doesn't happen, big deal. I always thought this was sort of an artificial benchmark, but it wasn't to her, and it was a motivation to her, and it was the equivalent of a rivalry to her. And if this is what motivated her, and if this is what gave her a reason to go to the court and keep her out here playing for a few more years, then great. But I do feel like, the cliche of hourglass times, the sand sifting through the hourglass, I can't imagine there are too many more chances, especially for someone that will turn 40 years old next year. So, right. Yeah, we'll see her in Australia. I mean, one thing really real quick about Australia that's interesting, I saw one of the emails from Tennis Australia that went out to the players and essentially said, you need to be here 2 weeks. I mean, Australia has something like 20 cases. It's very low, but the big fear is people will bring it in from overseas. So if you're coming from overseas, you need a 2-week quarantine. So does Serena bring her family? Do all players, Rafa Nadal, Roger Federer, do all these players go down December 15th or so to Australia and spend 2 weeks in quarantine? It's a nice, great country, nice time of year. The players were told that they're not going to have to sit in their hotel room. They'll be able to practice. But, that's a big request. I mean,
right.
So if she wants to play the Australian Open, she'll be spending, I mean, she doesn't celebrate religious holidays, but she will be, spending Christmas time in another hemisphere. So it's yet another twist in this strange time we're living in.
And truth of the matter is, that's not that far away. You know, I mean, we're obviously in October, and those are plans where once she gets back home and takes a breath from, you know, the French Open and everything else, you've got to start thinking about that already. So that's why I think it's interesting that she, to your point, you know, I made the decision at this point after playing, you know, a little bit, but not fully. You know, it's just a very interesting decision. And, you know, we hope that she's healthy, but it's going to be another, not as quick, but interesting transition to the Australian Open, given the timing of it all.
Yeah, it's funny because we always complain. I think rightfully players complain about the off season being so minimal in this sport, being negligible. And this year, it looks like it's going to be cut by 2 weeks. The flip side of that is who knows how many more events, if any, we have the rest of the year. But in a sport that already doesn't have much in the way of the off season, players are now going to have to go to Australia in the middle of December, which, yeah, as you say, exactly. You think about it in terms of time, this is barely 2 months from now. So it's strange times and workarounds, and everyone's adjusting. I mean, I'll tell you a story. I was told that the WTA was really trying to effort to put together some sort of a year-end event, not the Shenzhen final. I mean, that is what it is, and it's in China, and they have a sponsor, and it's not happening this year, but some sort of a final event in Prague, and that players were sticking around, and there were even, you know, players weren't getting on planes because they were all waiting for this big announcement. And then last 72 hours, COVID rates in the Czech Republic have spiked. The Czech Republic has some version of a lockdown. I think sponsors are getting a little bit, and promoters are getting a little bit nervous about how are we going to pay all this prize money if we're not selling tickets, or if they're reduced tickets. And now it looks like this indoor event in the Czech Republic isn't happening. I mean, 72 hours ago, you have players that didn't want to go home because they thought they were going to have some more playing opportunities. And now those events seem to be dissolving. So everything's moving fast. Everyone is sort of scrambling. A lot of this is out of tennis's control. It's probably like this in a lot of, it's obviously is it unique to tennis, but it's just a really, really strange time overall. And I think a lot of players are now resigned that they're done for the year, and see you in Australia. And if it means leaving Europe or leaving the United States on December 15th, and so be it.
Right. The other question we talked about a little bit earlier today, but the weather and everything, of course, is creating a weird mood, but it has also impacted scheduling and just general how players are performing. And I think even seeing the players in long sleeves and pants and everything else was just sort of a weird sight for the French Open. But how has the environment, the conditions impacted the player? I mean, you're there, you've stepped foot on the clay itself. How different is it really? And how much has it, who has it impacted the most?
You know, you have these really dueling instincts in tennis, I find. This is going to be a long windup to a good question that you ask. But you have these two dueling instincts, right? One of them is that tennis players are resilient and adaptable, and they change surfaces, and they change countries, they change tactics in a match. And, you know, Billie Jean King's, you know, her two-word maxim, champions adjust, is often quoted. I think there's real truth to that. And tennis players, in some ways, have great sort of pliability. And in other ways, tennis players are really creatures of habit, some more than others. I mean, you look at Nadal as an obvious example with his various rituals. But, you know, like Alina Svitolina was almost brought to tears the other day when she was asked about the loss of her dog. And I thought she was talking about her pet. And then people explained it was like a lucky child. It was like a toy dog. It was a talisman that she left in a hotel room. And here's a woman in her mid-20s, and she's deeply upset about talking about her lost toy dog. And I think the reason is there is ritual, there is superstition. Tennis players are creatures of habit. They like things to be just so. They like to know what they're wearing and when they're getting on a plane, and they like their schedule. And I think that was my long windup to say that, you know, at some level, this is what tennis players do. And sometimes it rains and sometimes it doesn't. And you never know when your match is going to go on, and you never know how long your match is going to be. And in other ways, yeah, it's really jarring to play on a surface that doesn't play the same way 2 days in a row, or to get moved from indoors to playing under a roof. Or, yeah, I mean, it's been, right now, I'm freezing, as you could probably tell in my voice. And they look like they're alpine skiing. I mean, Victoria Azarenka took the court the other day looking like she was going to her mogul's race. I mean, it's freezing cold. And then the next day it's, you know, 68 degrees and everybody's back playing in baseball caps and shorts. So I think some players will adjust to this better than others. I think one thing we don't talk about enough is how much of an advantage it is for players like Djokovic and Nadal and now Simona Halep to know they're going to play all their matches on the same court, which has a roof if it rains. And if you're, you know, third on, you're third on, you're not going to get shuffled.
Right.
And so the top players, I mean, it's there's a bit of irony to it, but in some ways the top players have to do the least amount of adjusting. They're not the ones out here on, you know, court seven with their coach having an umbrella. You know, there have been matches where the coaches have had umbrellas and the play's gone on. Top players don't have to deal with that. So I think, you know, there's a lot of adjusting that's being asked of these players in all sorts of different ways. But the irony is that the players at the very top don't have to confront a lot of these variables.
Definitely. And so we talked at the beginning of the tournament, of course, but what are your, are you sticking with predictions? Have you, are you picking any second week sleepers here? What's the outlook as we turn the corner on the first week at the French Open?
You know, it's funny. We keep picking sleepers and then disappear. I mean, somebody, I think Courtney, I'll hold, we often quote Courtney when we, you know, in deep admiration. So we will know Courtney, I think it was facetious, but you think, I'm calling it right now. Stan Wawrinka wins this tournament. Stan Wawrinka just got knocked out by a player outside the top 200. I don't know. I love this. Clara Toussaint was so impressive beating Jen Brady. And I sort of was telling everyone, you got to watch her. This is a 17-year-old, remember the name. And then, she lost in straight sets. So I make no bold predictions. I mean, Tsitsipas looked great, but, you know, now that I say that, Lord knows what he has in store in his next match. I think you sort of got to go with chalk here, and I would be very surprised. I was thinking there's something, you know, another way in which tennis is a cruel sport. Simona Halep comes in, she's the favorite, she hasn't lost since the Australian Open. She won her match today against Anna Samova. 6-0, 6-1. She's lost 12 games in six sets. If she doesn't win, she will be so deeply disappointed and say, "What? Where did it all go wrong? I was playing so well. I was moving well. The conditions were to my liking. Mm-hmm. Other seeds were dropping out. The defending champion didn't show. The woman who beat me last year, I surrendered one game to her." If she somehow does not win this tournament, it's going to be like, what the hell happened? Everything had lined up so perfectly. But I do think Simona Halep is her woman's winner. And I think, I don't know. I mean, I think Djokovic is going to be really hard to beat on this surface. I think whether there's a roof or not will have a huge impact if Nadal and Djokovic play. Dominic Thiem has looked terrific as well. I think I picked Rafa mostly by dint of respect for 12 titles. I'll stick with it. I don't think there's going to be some fluky result. I cannot imagine, you know, pick a name. I'm just looking at the, you know, Sebastian Korda. I can't imagine Ostapenko winning her second French Open. I think those are all nice stories, and it's great to see deep runs by unsuspecting players. But I think in the end, I can't imagine a player outside the top 10 winning either draw.
I will put a shout out to former podcast guest Jannik Sinner, who's up now, but making a little bit of a run here. So always good to see some former guests doing well at the majors.
Tsitsipas, Dominic Thiem. I'm trying to think who never had Djokovic.
Oh, yeah, we've got a lot of them.
Jannik Sinner, though, is
recent podcast guest.
Jannik Sinner, recent podcast guest, who, as you will recall, was like Joe Biden. He went on some lovely tangent about, you know, Sammy Soup Spoon. You know, he had spinning yarns like an old man. He's a lovely kid and such a composed and unflustered. I mean, the comparisons he always draws are to Roger, and it's not necessarily his game. It's just sort of a kid who doesn't seem to have a care in the world, who's, you know, friendly with everyone. It's really interesting how different players approach this sport differently. And with him, you can't really tell if he's winning or losing. It would be unthinkable to see this kid, you know, smash a racket or call the chair umpire a moron. For other players, it's exactly the opposite, and this sport can accommodate them all. But no, Jannik Sinner, a rare teenage phenom, looks like he's going into the fourth round now pretty easily, doesn't it?
Yeah. Any other reports from on the ground, rumors, reports? We love them both. So anything else to add?
Rumors, reports. Let's see. No, I mean, I think the big story apart from the action is just what the hell is going to happen to the rest of the year and what's going to happen in 2021. And I think the big fight is going to be, you know, tournament directors and promoters saying, listen, I'll put on your event. I'll put on the tournament. But if I'm not selling tickets, or I'm only selling a fraction of the tickets, you can't expect me to pay usual prize money. And that's something that will have to be negotiated. And then the other part to that is, are the top players going to play if they're only going to make dimes on the dollar? The other thing I think is interesting is usually this is the time of year when players assess their coaching situation. And do I keep this thing going? Do I need a new coach? There's usually a fair amount of churn in terms of personnel, but a lot of those, you know, a lot of those marriages get made in the players' lounge. Well, that doesn't really happen here. And there's a lot of PowerPoints being made. I mean, there actually aren't a ton of players without coaches right now, though there are a few. And they're not a ton of coaches that are out of work. Thomas Hogstad, who split up with Joe Konta, quickly caught on with Ostapenko. But it is interesting that usually this is the time of year when players and coaches assess their relationship and sometimes move on. And that doesn't seem to be happening. It must be happening over Zoom, because it's not happening in the players' lounge right now.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's one of the many things that we don't realize, you know, watching from afar, but someone who, you know, is on the grounds every day, and for players, of course, they recognize it. So.
Strange year, strange times, but I think tennis should be pleased that looks like we're going to hand out, you know, we're going to hand out trophies at three of the four majors, and the fourth one that had the good fortune of having pandemic insurance was very generous and gave out some prize money anyway. So another sector making some adaptations to a very, very strange year.
That is definitely what this year is. we look forward to watching the rest of the tennis and hearing from you again next week.
You got it. Yeah, absolutely. Let's check in next week and we can see where we are. Hopefully, we'll have fewer players and hopefully a lot fewer COVID cases.
Yes, hopefully. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Jamie. Thanks again for your expertise, your podcast sorcery. Thanks to everyone for listening. Again, it is Friday evening. That's where we stand. Hopefully this won't be too obsolete by the time you listen to it, but we will do another podcast from Roland Garros 2020 again in a few days. Thanks, everyone. Thanks to our sponsor. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And leave a review, subscribe, iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. And have a good few days. Enjoy week 2 of 2020 Roland Garros.